Hello and welcome to Preprints in Motion.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers and discuss their latest preprint and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia. But we don't stop there. Every month we'll be bringing you special episodes with open science leaders where we discuss how to fix academia. Easy, right? So hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod. But for now, let's get into the show. This week we're joined by Stefano Vianello to talk about prefigurative preprints. Thank you for joining us. You were requested by a couple of people, actually, based on the back of that really interesting article you wrote, which we'll get to. But I thought we'd start with your recent preprint that article is kind of about. So you're a developmental biologist in terms of your background. So could you tell us a little bit about sort of what you've worked on in the past, what your lab work is?
So I've always worked in developmental biology. I work with embryonic stem cells, mouse in my case, and we use them to make these in vitro models of embryo development that are called gastruloids, which essentially are, you take the cells and then you let them aggregate in medium, and they form a ball that then breaks symmetry by itself and then elongates. And when people have studied this, they've seen that it recapitulates many features of how the embryo develops, even though in vitro in the lab they're not getting any of the cues from the mother that the embryo would get. And so you can make a lot of them because you make them in 96 well plates. And yeah, that's what I work on. And specifically, I mean, in my PhD project, I've been studying them for the endoderm, so for the tissue that will make the gut tube and other organs, and how we can use them to study endoderm and generate endoderm in vitro from an embryonic perspective.
That's cool. They I've seen microscopy images of those, and they always look really cool.
Yeah, I like doing immunostaining on them and getting nice pictures.
Yeah, they are always really cool. So what we're going to talk to you today, though, is not really any of that sciencey stuff. We're going to be talking about more, I guess, academic culture and the publishing side of things. Mm-hmm. So how did you get interested in that, seeing as how you're a developmental biologist?
I mean, I've always been interested in the topic of openness, open source, open access, even from my family point of view. And then the lab, I was doing my master's and my undergraduate research in, which was in Cambridge, the lab of Alfonso Martinez Arias. My PI then was very in favor and encouraging and promoting open science practices. So when I started my PhD in 2014, 15. It was also more or less the time when in biology, at least in developmental biology, bioarchive was starting to be used or accepted. And so I entered academia in this context and in the context of a lab that was approving of it and promoting it. And then in my PhD, I kept going for it. And also it's from your interaction, right, with the people around you and your experiences with people that don't support open science, right, that sometimes push you to go even stronger in exploring or in refining your position in all of this. If you're forced to advocate for your own points of view, you kind of start looking for information, looking for context, looking for why you're in it, and then it just evolves from there.
I mean, so BioArchive started up in 2013, so it must be quite cool to be in one of those labs that was an early adopter of the whole thing, because a lot of people sitting in the biosciences, it was really sort of 2017 onwards where you saw more of an uptake more generally across bioscience, outside of bioinformatics and neuroscience for some reason. They were both the early adopter fields. But I don't know what neuroscientists are on about, but they like preprints, apparently.
Yeah, and you also need, I mean, yeah, you also need to personally then want to adopt these things. But it's true that if any PI is listening, they really have a strong role in favoring this or helping students going towards this path or not in the opposite case.
Yeah, I think we've kind of been maybe a bit biased in who we select for this, but a lot of the people who've come on have always seemed to have had quite supportive PIs, and are, I think that helps a lot, because obviously if your PI doesn't want a preprint, ultimately there's not a lot you can do, much as you might like to argue with them.
Yeah, well, there is supporting and then not supporting. And I think the really unlucky situation is when you have a PI that is actively disapproving of preprints in this case. And then you have to fight or other strategies of survival.
Just give up and go along with it. It's the easy route. So you posted this preprint and you did this with the intention of sort of that being the end goal. And I'm just going to read out a bit from this article you've written because I think it kind of sums things up quite nicely. So the framing of the preprint as in the pre of a print, as if it was waiting for something else, as if it was incomplete, crystallizes a scenario where the preprint exists and is longing for something more. Which is really nice. Well written, that bit of writing there. So, but this kind of summarizes quite nicely the whole point of what we're going to be talking about today, which is the idea that, a bit like it works in physics, where the preprint is the final goal and then maybe publishing is for curation or just a formality, which is how physicists do. So what led you to take that decision?
So there is some degree of, I wouldn't say disappointment, but disagreement or non-alignment with the direction of some of this, or with the goals that initiatives or platform or whatever, the preprint servers or preprinting seems to be designed for or against. I come from a standing point where I don't want the alternative publishing practice or initiative to be a parallel thing to journals still existing or journals still getting something out of it. So like publishing on a preprint platform to then still sending to a journal, or reviewing for a preprint curation initiative to then sending this review or getting hired by a journal. You know, I would prefer initiatives that are clearly designed to disrupt the problematic situation. There, of course, there is that point that they won't get approved by the majority of people, and so. But I would like less being in between.
Yeah, and this is this idea of prefigurative politics, right? So this idea that you behave in the way in the change that you want to see, right?
Yeah. The concept of prefigurative was also to reclaim the word preprint itself, to make it lose this aspect of still validating the normalization of there being a print. In my case, I don't want my work to be in a journal, even though there's different degree of journals. And so I'm not putting it there, as I wrote, like, I'm not putting it there because the statistics show that you will get more citation, or because I can't wait, I don't want to wait 2 years of review and then have it there. I just don't want any of these things. So, and you can just post it there if you're fine with not being in a journal. And also by putting it like that, actually it enhances, or it gives you more, it transforms the preprint that you're going to put. Because if you're putting it there for an end goal journal, you're going to put it there with all the constraint of the journal you want to get it in. So the layout. So it also reduces some of the advantages that the preprint platform would have allowed you to get.
Yeah, formatting has not been a fun couple of weeks for me. Feels like all I do every time. So we submitted, our last paper was submitted to BioArchive with the intention of that being its final resting place. We weren't intending to submit that to a journal because I was senior author, and as a postdoc, you don't have money to pay the publishing fees. And I don't want to publish work that isn't open access. As it happens, we did end up submitting to a journal because another group came along who wanted to collaborate with us, and they're going to pay our fees for us, which is very nice of them. So we've been stuck in that reformatting round for a little bit now, because I keep not doing the right formatting every time they send it back to me. But hopefully the last one went off today. One of the other things that is really good about your print in particular, because we can use this as a really good example, is that yours was also peer-reviewed, and that peer-review is alongside of it on BioArchive. So one of the benefits, of course, of preprint services is that you can update your work as you go. So if you get some peer review or some feedback, you can update, which I think you guys did.
Yeah. So yeah, even there, so you're never sure whether people like that. So I mean, I've read some people that are big in preprints don't see it as a place where to put living documents or this kind of changing version. We did. So I published it, I think, 1 year ago, and then maybe more. I mean, immediately after, we just put a small correction of like citation, this kind of thing. And then 1 year later, I think it was exactly 1 year later, we added a whole second part of it, because people know that, that preprint was about endoderm and gastroloid. So now there's going to be more about it on the same topic, and the versions are there and you can see them. Then my PI put it on Twitter, the announcement that it had been updated with more. And I see preprint as a living thing that you just update until whenever you want, you add things, you change things, you make it stronger and stronger with more and more information on that topic.
So I like that idea. That's sort of how I tend to use preprints. The fact that you can change stuff is great, even if it is something simple like a typo, because the moment you submit to a journal, that's when you find all your typos. Not before. Never, ever, ever before. I swear somebody inserts the typos when you press submit. There's a little thing that goes through and just puts them in randomly.
Yeah, also for preprints.
anytime there's a submit button, that submit button comes with the cost of a few typos. That's the price you pay for pressing the button. I forgot what I was going to say now. I got distracted by typos. So you can update and stuff. But I guess a flip side to that is that, so you mentioned that you added this quite big section and the PI announces this on Twitter. That's great. But what if you're someone who maybe is from a small lab, who maybe your name's not very well known, maybe not got a big Twitter following? What would you suggest for that situation? Because then if you update your preprint, chances are, even if you announce it, nobody's really going to notice. And that's the difference between, say, posting a subsequent preprint or a paper.
Yeah, so I dislike that part. I mean, I was like you, I mean, both of you in pre-light. So in highlighting curation, in situation where you're picking which preprints are worth to be highlighted, and there's a lot of problems with that too. So I don't like that aspect that, I mean, it's people that are already known lab that get their research known. And known even more. So I don't have a recommendation for the person in the lab that is not known to make their research known. But the recommendation is for the readers, that people that are looking, I mean, all of us, that want to see information that is not by these same labs, to search intentionally and to search preprint servers intentionally away from the first thing that comes out or the lab that anyway they're going to see. And there's a lot of value in that. In my case, I'm in a lab that I think we could not say, I mean, we cannot say anything. It would be searched and it would be seen. But I think from a small lab, publishing a new preprint or an update of a previous preprint will have similar effect. I think when you update the preprint, it still goes to the top page.
Yeah, they do on BioArchive and MedArchive at least, yeah.
But yeah, I think the change should be, I mean, the burden of this should be on the readers if they want to feel the need to. And then, because if the readers don't feel the need of wanting more complete information and are happy just reading the same labs, then also there's no point in trying to convert them.
I think there are certain particularly big names who are not gonna come round to any of the ideas here at all, because it's not how they work, it's not what they understand, shall we say nicely.
Yeah, but I have to say I've always been in big names lab, so I speak from that not never having had that problem. But also from someone that doesn't want to read the research from big name labs.
So, I mean, people would probably describe you slightly more radical than I am, and I think I seem to push for quite a lot of change. But you would push for a complete rethinking of the whole publishing structure, whereas I still can kind of see places for journals, I guess, maybe. So you've outlined sort of four key points that you think sort of need to be changed in your article. So I figured it would be good if we just took those one by one. So your first point is that we should refuse both closed access publishing and the article processing charge based open access models. I hate the APC charge. All they've done is shift the charge to us instead of where it was originally. Would you like to expand on that a little bit? I mean, I agree completely on that point.
I even have t-shirts that say refuse APC. So this is the thing I'm going to fight for. It's more so some journals, I don't know if we can make journal names, but like
name whoever you want.
Yeah. So eLife at least is self-aware and explicitly lists or describes the problems with their publishing model of APCs. That's still a problem because you're asking people to pay you money and not to make it open access, to not put the paywalls that the journal will put otherwise. So it's like it's some sort of ransom in a sense. And the thing that annoyed me, and I think it's PhD students should know, it's like when a journal tells you you can publish freely with us, and the freely means a paywalled article, and then you tell them, oh, well, I don't want, you're paywalling my article, and then they tell you, no, you can also put it open access, but that's not the free version. That's not a real choice that you can make. And doesn't matter if you're going to use that money or whatever nice support initiative or funding scheme. It's more that you're putting an inequitable step towards doing good with that money in some way, where you could have just from the beginning found alternative income or activities that doesn't require authors publish this. So even though there's nuances and different versions that you can rate this APC uses or justification, we need to refuse it from the beginning. Like, no, I'm not going to pay you. Yeah. So I'm going to put it somewhere that allows me to do just that without either putting paywalls and doesn't charge me for not putting them.
And I think we got to remember where the money for all this comes from, because for the most part, all this money is coming from charitable donations. And I'm pretty certain the average person walking down the street would not be overly happy to know that their charitable money has just gone to line some publisher's pocket.
Yeah.
And we've got, you know, I mean, these publishers are not just, we've covered this in previous episodes, but they've got profit margins. Some of them have profit margins bigger than Apple and Google, and we're doing all the work. So they're not doing much for us. You know, they're not doing anything for us, because it's not like they do all the formatting for us. It's not like they'll do the press release for us or they'll promote the article for us. We do all of that. We write all those things. We do the peer review for them. And so it's a system where holding us to hostage is quite a good way of putting it, I think, actually. Only we're also holding the gun for some reason.
Yeah.
And no, they're very hands off. And so I think we're certainly with the pandemic, we're probably getting to a point where at some point we'll see a big expose in a big newspaper or on some big TV channel about the publishing system in academia, because I don't think people actually appreciate and understand how it works outside of science. And in science, we just accept it wrongly, as that's how it is.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the accepting. It's not just the information. No, I mean, it's more that the people in academia that know this, I mean, people that work in publishing know this because it's their job. So first of all, for any like PhD student that is listening to this, there are papers on publishing, on the consequences of APC, on inequalities built in different publishing models. So when you're going to either oppose or support. You're not just saying a weird conspiracy theory that you just invented. You're just saying things that are studied, and whether these studies reach your area of academia or not, that's another problem. But and if they don't, like, why is no one in this community talking about this? Why is everyone pretending APC disapproval is something weird? Then that's the problem of the community in which you're in. But there are research exactly on this.
That's a good point. There is, I think, often all scientists would benefit from stepping back and actually looking at how we do science more. And there's a lot of research on this. In the UK, there's now a Research on Research Institute that looks specifically at all these kind of topics. I've done a little bit of this. And there's a lot, there are a lot of labs who look at research and how we do research and the process of not just publishing, but so there's a really good paper going around Twitter at the moment about p-value and how easy it is to manipulate and why we shouldn't be relying on the p-value. But often you still see people relying on p-values because it's just how it's done, right? And people don't take the step back to think about all of this. And so one of the other things you mentioned is this idea of this cost introduces this inequality in publishing, because obviously if you're a postdoc, you've got no money to pay these costs. If you're not from the West or one of the richer Asian countries, you haven't got the money necessarily to publish and pay these costs. If you're from Africa, you don't have the money to be wasting on these kind of costs. A lot of African researchers that I know do have the money to pay these, but that money would be much better spent in somewhere where they could hire a new lab tech with that money, or they could do a bit more research with that money. I think we're a little bit spoiled in the West in that, relatively speaking, we have a lot of money in research and there is a lot of waste with that money, this being one of those wastes. But that kind of leads us on to the second point of your four key points, which is to decenter the global north scientific outputs, conceptions of science, and evaluations of science. And this is, again, really important point, because certainly at the moment, science is very much, it's not just global north, it's Western centric. It's America and Europe, basically, control science output for the most part at the moment, which isn't how it's always been. So I'm reading I've been reading it for about 3 months now. By reading a book about the history of science, and it used to be that, you know, science was based in Iraq, and that was the center of science. Science before that has been based in Japan and China, and that was the center of science. And it just so happens that currently it is in America, really, I guess. Although it looks like China and Japan are kind of pulling it back from America. So how do we tackle that? I mean, preprints help a little bit because they make things a bit more equal. But again, if you've not got, it's how you get your word out about that science, I guess. Because if that's not your first language, you know, most of science at the moment is written in English. And if that's not your first language, I've seen people complaining about peer review reports where the reviewers are saying, we're not going to accept this just because the English is bad, which is nonsense. Because if the science is good, that should be all that matters. So how do we tackle that little big challenge?
So this may be links back to, I mean, discussion about being in a big lab in a small lab. Yeah, again, so for me, it doesn't seem, so if you're a postdoc PhD student and in Western academia and all the conferences about your topic have only speakers from USA, Europe, Japan, Australia, so global north, and never from the global south or peripheries, or is, you know, even the peripheries within Europe, so Czech Republic, Lithuania. So there's like a fractal center periphery thing going on. You know, then you start really to believe that, oh, maybe developmental biology is only done in these countries. You need to first start to refuse that. So I don't care if you tell me that developmental biology was born with Aristotle. I will just say no. And I refuse to believe that no one was doing developmental biology before that. And also no one is doing developmental biology now outside of these places. And it's just that you're not inviting them, you're not looking for them, you're not reading them. And again, you're not looking for preprint for them. And even that's another layer, that even when you want to read these things, like I want to read developmental biology preprint from the Philippines, for example, you cannot easily search for them on some platform, because very simply, you cannot search by author affiliation. So by default, you're always searching by the most common affiliation that there is, which is USA, UK. So you really need to go intentionally through a lot of hoops to find the information that is not appearing in front of you, which you can do, but it needs to be a decision. It needs to be a decision that only comes once you decided that you want to see that information. And so if by default a PhD student doesn't do anything because it doesn't have time or just it doesn't realize that there's other research that is not being shown to them, then they won't do it. Again, we have to reclaim our agency in all of this and refuse things that are presented as the norm and say, well, I'm not going to go to this conference because I already know who's going to speak there, like all the past years, or I'm going to search for a conference organized in Southeast Asia. Maybe there is a Society of Developmental Biology there that no one is telling me about. Yeah. And it's, I mean, in our case, a case of, I'm Italian, so it's still you from a Western academia going somewhere else as a person from Western academia. So then your intention may be questionable. You're doing complete science by not considering. It's like if you were doing a review and that's what happens. No, it's like you're doing a review and you're only citing research from one part of the world. So if I was just to cite Italian research, someone would tell me, what about all this UK stuff? But if I only cite UK, USA, and European science, no one is coming, because who is judging me is also someone telling me, look, you didn't cite any developmental biology from this other country. Because for many people, it doesn't exist, or it's not relevant, or it's not serious, or is just local and is not valid.
Yeah. I mean, chances are they're going to be asking you to cite more of their work anyway if they ask.
Also. Yes.
I mean, open science kind of helps a bit with some of this, but this is a much bigger problem with science in general and society in general, really. It's things like where funding goes and how we distribute wealth across the world. It's things like representation is really important. That was a really good point, I thought, where, I hate conferences, mainly because once you've been to one, you don't need to go to another one for 5 years at least, because all the speakers are the same and they don't talk about new stuff. They might have a slide in that's new that they did this year. But everything else is just, oh, this is what I did 20 years ago. Aren't I amazing? And they're not, because they did it 20 years ago and I don't care anymore. And it's mostly presenting work that's already published. So I've already read it. So why are you telling me a bit? I've read it, I've seen it, I'm bored now. So, I mean, I think some of the things we could do as those people at the bottom of the totem pole, and sometimes quite often reminded of that, I think we can do things like push for better representation in our seminar speakers, for example. Get more women speakers in because they're underrepresented. Get less white men who are middle class. Get rid of those. We don't need any more of those, really. You know, get more people who are not from the UK. Invite people who are outside the UK if you're hosting a series in the UK. Get people who aren't big name professors. Get postdocs and PhD students and people who've just started.
Yeah, if I can add to that also, realizing that you don't need to get them in your conference. Like, they are organizing conferences on their own. And PhD students or development scientists from another country. And you can just attend as an audience without feeling like you're doing a favor to other people. But yeah, exactly. So, and it's not being against the big names in the field, is that these big names will be seen and their research known regardless. Now I want to know more and other things. And at the same time, I will still hear about yours just by being in this context. But you cannot do both. So as a preprint highlighter, I cannot highlight both. Like, I'm going to highlight people from this famous lab and people from less famous lab. This is, again, this intermediate thing that I don't like. Just highlight what you want to promote, and the other one will still be known. And you're doing more change than trying to please, like, both sides.
I should say, for clarity, I am pretty against the big names. I think anyone who remotely follows my Twitter will see that I'm a bit ageist. Only when it comes to academia. Don't like the big names.
Yeah.
So we've kind of already covered your third point pretty well, actually, which is to reclaim individual agency as part of the sort of the system, accountability from institutions and societies. One of the things that I think is quite difficult with all three points we've had so far is that a lot of how we're judged in academia is, unfortunately, all these things we don't want. So we're judged on publishing and where that paper goes. And, you know, one of the things you said in your piece was everyone was asking you where you've submitted it to. And every time you have a paper, people go, oh, where is it? Where's it going? As if that I mean, it matters to some people. But how do we do these things without causing a lot of damage to our careers if we want to stay in science? Because if you don't want to stay in science, then great, you can do all these things and it's fine. You can leave and you'll still have a very successful, probably happier life and career than you would if you stayed in science. But if you stay in science, you do, to a certain extent, you do have to play the current game in order to get a fellowship, because otherwise it's a lot harder to do that. I mean, it's a lot harder to do that if you don't come from a big name lab.
So what I on one end, if leaving science is better, why are people wanting you to stay in science in some broad point of view? The other one is, they tell you that you have to, most of the time, have to publish in this journal, which might be really true or not really true in all cases. But then to succeed in what? In a career where I have to keep doing things that I don't want to do, to be in that career that is where I do things that I don't want to do, you know? Or, you know, to get a grant, you have to write this thing that in a way that you really don't like how to write. And then what? Get the grant to continue doing this thing you don't want to do. So that's where the whole thing crumbles, because why are you telling me that to succeed in the career I need to do this? This is not the career I would like to do. And of course, we would like to do science, you know, another type of science or another type of academia. But that means leaving the academia that is made like that. So it doesn't mean leaving academia at all, but it's leaving this academia for which I have to play this game. And I'm going to look for rare places or create them yourself where people, you know, are not judging me on where I published the paper. And in reality, there are, even though not many. And that's where you want to do your career in. So you're telling me that I need to publish here, but I don't want to be in your lab that wants students to publish like that. So there's no problem. We're not made for each other in some way. But at the same time, you kind of have to have this, be ready to not get this success, even though you're not sure what the alternative success would look like. People tell you that you're not going to succeed unless you do this thing that you don't want to do. It means that you don't want this form of success there. I mean, it wouldn't be success, and it's not success if you get the position in a bad system.
Yeah, I mean, so I had this discussion recently with someone over lunch, and he wants to leave academia very much for this reason, because he doesn't like how it works. And this is the thing that's pushing me out more than anything else, is that the system just doesn't work, and it's not a fair system. There's nothing good about the system, I think, at the moment. And I do think it is, I don't think it's impossible to change from the inside, but I think it is very, very difficult. And I think you need the people who are tenured effectively to be the ones who drive that change, because they are in a position where they could carry on in academia and never publish in a journal again, and they're not going to lose their job. So they can do that. And if enough of those people did that, then the journals would have to change their approach. The funders would have to change their approach. So I think it is possible within academia. I just don't think it's ever going to happen.
Yeah, it's that this change, people that can change from within, you can do it at time scales that are much longer, if you really do it, that are much longer than the lifespan of a PhD or a postdoc. So if, because in concrete terms, if you are changing the situation, takes longer than 4 years, I already left academia because you haven't changed anything by being. So that's why also this prefigurative project, it's a lifeline for people that are in the system now and they need to survive. So you can survive by enacting it now, what this future will be for everyone else later. And then you are surviving these 4 years. And at the same time, you actually change the system now. So from this point of view, I mean, how many generations are you sacrificing until your change from within actually take place? But there is something. So that's why I was happy to discover this concept of, these ideas of prefigurative or which are, I mean, they're political movements.
I think this leads nicely into point number four of your key points, which is starts with actively. So actively and intentionally oppose capitalism, colonialism, and patriarchy in every aspect of the scientific process, which is, I mean, some of these points are big points anyway, but that's a really big point. So, those things, I think, have ran through academia forever. As long as thought has existed, those things seem to have gone straight through that whole process, because it doesn't matter how far back you go, it's always men in charge of doing it. It's always men at the top, in the top roles, leading it and doing all the decision making. I mean, colonialism has a very unhappy relationship with science. And then capitalism, of course, runs through science for everything, because everything is about money in science, whether that's the publication aspect or the ridiculous markup that we have to pay for various lab reagents. Water, you wouldn't think water could cost quite so much, or bits of plastic could quite cost as much as they do. And, so these things obviously are so almost central to what academia is. I guess this leads very much into the fact that we need to break it down and think of it and build it up again from the start.
Yeah.
Right?
So, I mean, the whole system is based on that. But it is more recognizing them in the practices and in the small things that are the rules or the, paying APCs or having open access based on money or, just looking at research, just thinking that scientists that work on cancer biology are in United States and Europe. So these forms of these big topics and just refusing them, and you cannot make them disappear, but you can refuse participating in them. And then there is so many people that are not opposed to it and are fine with perpetuating them. So it's just as easy to not be fine with it, and that's it. I mean, it's just asking to not be fine with it and then possibly do something about it, which might mean leaving academia, but it doesn't have to be, and can be creating a small bubble of academia that is not directly governed like that.
I mean, even just something as simple as sort of self-education, right, must be, that's a step in the right direction. As long as if you're actively thinking about all these things, then you're doing something. Even if you're not even if you're not actually doing anything external, your mindset
and
will.
The scholarly societies that are for the community should help in this. Should have a list of a critical literature on these topics, instead of trying to hide it or saying that that's how they have to work. But you can be self-reflective as a person or as a society. And that would show more help trust from the people that belong to your community, because otherwise it just based on suspicion and people don't align with you anymore because they don't know where you stand on some issues. Self-education, and not just self-education, looking for the education that you want and that you need. And that might not be what you get from the rest of your community automatically. That's the thing. You might have to completely recurate your Twitter feed or whatever it is, your newsletters and your subscriptions towards other directions. But there are entire communities and labs and social science groups that have this information and study this information and that give you this information. And then you can share them with people in your community yourself.
So on that note, what is the, this might be a difficult question, what is the one thing you'd want people to come away from this conversation and do or think about?
Really, that you refuse. You have to refuse. You have to refuse all these things that, I mean, it sounds like a teenager rebellion thing, but like what you can say, no, this is not how things are going because I'm not going like that. And you are part of this, how things are going. And really think about what you want to do, what you want to contribute to, and find the, in this, find the power to do it. Because you can really be powerless, but by doing it, even though you cannot do it, you get the power to do it in some circumstances. But yeah, there's a lot of power in refusing and in enacting your vision now and surviving it. And at the same time, possibly changing it in your small area of influence.
There you go. Be a rebellious teenager. I think that might be my smoothest ending to an episode yet.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows. Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsandmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.